Hello, everyone. I'm Drew.
I'm Bailey.
I'm Lacey.
And we're sarcastic, so let's get sinister. Huh?
Finally.
What?
ASMR.
Oh, no.
You were ASMRing.
Oh, that's a shame. Anyone you know, or...
I said people, so obviously I don't know all of them.
No, I know. I said anyone you know. Like, do you see just random people that are strangers to you, or are you seeing, like, people you know?
Oh, usually strangers. I feel like I know them, though, you know, because I see them so much.
You sound very quiet to me today.
I had to turn the volume up on my laptop.
Maybe.
Are you talking to me or her?
Bailey.
I mean, I'm talking quieter.
I have been sending Lacey everything I can find. Well, everything that I come across on TikTok about plane crashes. I don't want to jinx you.
Why would you do that to her?
Because I want to share... the facts. But I don't... You're going to be flying.
Flight coming up, so I'm assuming for choice.
Yeah.
But she's scared.
Yeah. As she should be, based on the
TikTok. Never fly again.
So you're just scaring her more.
Yes.
Feet firmly on the ground from now on.
She's about to be... very important.
But Lacey,
you
cannot be disposable. So
Lacey,
yeah,
needs to be how many safer choices?
How many car crashes happen comparatively to plane crashes?
So many, I might not get in those anymore either.
Oh, and trains.
It's a risky world.
You should just stay indoors.
I'm just pointing out that there seems to be a strange influx in plane crashes. It's still considered the safest way to travel. It's just weird.
We're lucky we've survived this long.
I want Lacey to be aware.
Didn't we talk about how... I swear we talked about last time how... Is it actually an influx, or are we just, like, hearing about it more?
Yes, we did talk about that. And then shortly afterwards, I found a TikTok where it was, like, a guy was, like, compiled all of them and was, like, there's actually been an influx. He's, like, since... January, there's been like two a week. There's so many that they just don't report on half of them. Only the big ones. And he said like 87 people have died in plane crashes since the beginning of the year.
Not great. You know.
That's the spirit, Bale. And then also that one pilot that got arrested for a DUI while he was getting his plane ready.
I mean, it's a stressful time. He's just trying to cope. Is it the right answer? No, but, you know.
I also sent her a video today of a Southwest plane nearly missing another plane. Like, it landed, touched down, and then they pulled up real quick because another was, like, taxiing across the runway, and they would have collided had he not done that.
I will say... like, I know they have radar and everything, but their windows are fucking tiny as shit. Like, some people can't even drive with looking at, like, at their blind spot or knowing where their blind spot is. It's amazing that, like, more pilots don't hit each other.
Do the yes. pilots have the radar in their cockpit?
Movies I've seen, it looks like they do.
I thought that the tower is just, like, you're clear to land. Like, we've got the runway clear. There's no planes in the area. You're good to come in. Like, I thought that... And then they tell them, like, okay, that's your flight path. And that's why planes have to be communicating with the tower.
This is why, Bailey, you have to become an air traffic controller.
I mean, I'd have that
Give us
ship
the info.
In shape in, like, a week.
Exactly. You're the only one of us still eligible. And we have questions, so...
I mean, Drew seems to be really into the research, and next week is my episode, and it's a rather large episode, so it seems like Drew should research this further.
What exactly should I, whether or not there's a radar in the cockpit? That
No.
feels like a quick Google search.
Okay, great.
You two talk real quick.
This, I mean, it also goes back to my point of like, how the fuck do they see each other or see the ground?
I think they just know it's there.
It's a lot of trust and
Every
a lot
landing
of.
is the result of thoughts and prayers.
Okay, so they do have radar and it does supply real-time images, but the range is limited. And
I don't like that.
store. What?
I said I don't like that. We should be giving them better equipment.
Yeah, and then also a storm. So another hazard is that a storm on the screen might hide another storm. Onboard radar is also expensive to acquire and maintain. So only the good ones.
You're telling me Spirit won't have those on their flights?
Well, I don't know. Are they rich?
Well, I mean, I would assume so. Spirit's one of the cheapest flights or
You think they're
airlines.
spending all their money on radars?
I think it's a bare minimum that they should be spending them on. They're probably not spending it on the chairs.
Okay. Did you guys see that Michelle track?
Yes.
Yes, Harry the Spy.
Georgina from
Yes,
Gossip
me.
Girl.
I know her from when she was on Disney.
Yeah, I when you sent us the picture, I could recognize the face. Like I knew her from something, and I couldn't put whatever it was together. So I was Googling other stuff she was in because like I hadn't watched Gossip Girls, and I'd watched very little Buffy. But Harry the Spy and that one Disney movie about ice skating.
Ice
Yes,
Princess.
yeah, that was the other one that I remember from.
She was
39.
also in Eurotrip. 17 again.
Oh, she was in 17 again.
Inspector Gadget with that guy.
I don't know.
The 1991,
I think I
1999 one.
watched that
Matthew
one.
Broderick.
Okay. Oh, what's our case today?
She was in House. She did a whole lot. And she was only 39.
I could tell you the exact episode she was in House.
I could tell you too. She had like she was like allergic to everything.
No. She had
No.
severe allergies, but then went into got in a car crash. Her chest got cracked. She needed a heart, so she got that, and then she was in a clean room and had an allergic reaction to something and ended up being a tick. So she had Lyme disease from boyfriend.
What does
And her
that
mother
have to do with
was
her?
super overbearing.
Yeah. But yeah, I remember the boyfriend too. He had like blonde hair and he was super cool. Climbed
Yeah,
in through the window.
he was in Bring It On, All or Nothing with Brittany
Yeah.
Snow. Brad.
Lindsay has a cat with her today.
She has a cat with her every
Yes.
day.
He's about to
Most
be
days.
right here. There he is.
Hi, Sebastian.
You hear them? You wanna breathe at him? He's rubbing on the laptop. Hi.
Remember when you liked dogs?
Once you get a cat, it's hard to. I still like dogs. I would like a dog. Not right now. But, oh no, my microphone. The
Are we getting
cats
into the
are
case today?
unexpectedly fun.
Eventually.
Do you say cats are
Unexpectedly fun.
fun?
Yeah.
I'm in the process of trying to convince Pat to let me get another kitten.
Yes. They need a friend. You might not know that they do, but then you get one and
So,
you're
like,
like, they
I
do.
think Sylvia needs a friend. She would say no.
Yeah. We've decided that Sebastian and Dill are actually boyfriends.
Oh,
Yeah,
it doesn't
we
seem like they have a great relationship.
You don't see them all the time.
No, but I, Okay.
They are love hate. He has, I don't know if it'll you'll be able to see or not, a bald spot on the back of his neck. Somewhere here. From that's Dill's favorite place to bite him. And he's worn it bald.
Oh, you're
that's so a funny. That's a dominant thing.
I feel like if they were a gay couple, it would be Cam and Mitchell from Modern Family.
Yeah.
Sebastian is just like so lovable.
Yeah. And,
like wanting to be friendly.
Yeah.
And Dill is like, no. All right. How are you? You guys ready to get ready. In? All right. So.
This picture's concerning.
Okay.
You don't want that old lady to be Dorothy. I'll let you go ahead. Lead us in.
Switch it so that you guys stop being judgmental. At 12:30 a.m. Sorry, at around 12:30 a.m. on Sunday, June 23rd, 1991, Charles Holden had just finished his 4 p.m. to 11 p.m. shift and was stopping for a burger at Hardee's on his way home. In Harrington, Delaware, the Hardee's was situated at the intersection of U.S. Highway 13 and State Highway 14. Charles was 41 at the time, working at the DuPont Company factory. He lived in a trailer on his family's 163-acre farm. Grabbing a hamburger and a coffee was part of Charles's routine after his shift. He got his meal and crossed the parking lot to get to his truck. As he started to back out of his spot, he noticed a person out his window. Yes.
Cup of coffee at...
I don't know. Aunt Lacey, she drinks coffee more often.
Like, he gets off at 11 p.m. is what you said?
Maybe he likes the flavor.
Yeah. Maybe it's a decaf. They didn't specify.
Jesus.
So he's backing out of his spot, and he notices somebody out his window. It was a man, and the man asked Charles for a ride. Charles basically said he didn't know because it was kind of late, so he's like, I don't know, man. The guy was pretty insistent, and he told Charles that he was in a big-time bind. His sister had just given birth at Milford Memorial Hospital, and he needed to get there. The hospital is about 12 miles away from Hardee's, so about a 20-minute drive. Charles told the man that he lived close by, so he wouldn't be able to take him far. Harrington was a small town, mostly friendly, but he was trusting of the man, but he wasn't going to, like, go out of his way to deliver this man to a hospital because it was in the middle of the night. He just worked a shift. He wanted to go home. So Charles ended up agreeing, and he drove 3 miles down Highway 14. When he reached the intersection at Killen Pond Road, where he would normally turn to drive the half mile to go home, he pulled over. He told the man that this was as far as he could go and, you know, get out, basically.
Get to step in.
Yeah. It's like, you know, this is your stop.
TFO.
He told the stranger that there was a nearby phone booth. So, you know, call a taxi or something. I don't know. It's not really my problem, is basically what he was saying. He's next to step in. The stranger became irate. He told him he needed to get down the road and he wasn't getting out of the truck. Which, like, I'd be so mad. Like, dude, come on. Get the fuck out.
It's giving him any gas money?
No, it was 1991, so I don't think it was really a considered thing. And then also Charles was like, you know, it's on his way. You know?
I get that, but like also like if you're not giving him any incentive, he can tell you to kick rocks whenever he wants.
Exactly. But so Charles told him that he wasn't going to drive any further and was like, you know, I told you before you even got in that I wasn't going to take you far. So I don't know why this, like, you're all of a sudden getting out of your mind with upset. Like, It's not a surprise. That did little to soothe the man, and he was now fully infuriated. He repeated that he had no intention of getting out of the truck. Charles apologized, but stood his ground and was like, dude, like, I'm not driving anymore. I don't know what to tell you. The man then attacked Charles. He punched him in the face and demanded money and the keys. The man grabbed a screwdriver that had been rolling around on Charles's truck floor.
Oh, no.
And while he was reaching down to grab the screwdriver, Charles grabbed his keys and jumped out the door. He took off running to a nearby business called Blake's Garage. While he was running, the man slid over. It was like a bench seat, so there was no gap. He just slid right across the bench. He slid over to the driver's seat with the intention of trying to drive off, but then realized that the keys were missing. So he jumped out of the truck and took off after Charles. Charles was pounding on the windows of the garage, calling for help. But, you know, it's the middle of the night.
Yeah.
So no one was there. The man eventually caught up to Charles and, with the screwdriver still in hand, threatened to kill him and demanded his keys again. Charles pleaded with the man to calm down. And he was like, you know what? Okay, I'll take you wherever you want to go. All right? Just, you know, chill. So the man agreed and followed Charles back to the truck. Now, so Charles jumped out of the truck originally and just took off in a straight line to the garage. So as they were approaching the truck, they were approaching from the driver's side. So once Charles got into the truck, he quickly turned on the truck and took off, leaving the strange man just in the intersection in the dark with his screwdriver. And that's it.
Nice.
Charles drove in the opposite direction of his home, hoping to lead the man away from his trailer, thinking that the guy would, like, chase after him. He drove for about 20 minutes, just kind of aimlessly around, until he was convinced that the man likely moved on. So he turned around and headed back towards his home. Along the way, he kept his eyes peeled for the man, but he didn't see him anywhere. So Charles decided it was safe to go home. As he was approaching his driveway, he saw the stranger.
Oh, no.
Somehow, the man had found his way to Charles's trailer. Likely by coincidence.
Okay. I was going to ask, because he didn't take anything else out of the truck with him but the screwdriver, no. Right? Okay.
And it was a half a mile away from the intersection. Mm-hmm. He just coincidentally showed up in Charles's front yard, looking through the windows of his trailer.
That's weird.
Not wanting to get into another confrontation, Charles just kept driving. As he was driving away, he had an additional concern. His trailer, like I said before, was located on his family's farm. About 60 feet away from his trailer was the farmhouse.
Oh, no.
And living in that farmhouse, all alone, was Charles's 70-year-old mother, Dorothy Mae Donovan. So Charles drove until he came upon a payphone that was outside of Hardee's. So he drove back the 3 miles to Hardee's, and he pulled over and he called the police at 1:19 a.m. He told the police that the strange man was at his house and his mother lives alone next door. After alerting the authorities of the potential threat on his property, he tried calling his mother to also alert her of the possible danger. He called her several times, but she did not answer. Charles waited at the payphone for the police. His initial report was categorized as low priority, so Delaware State Police Corporal Myrna Williams Keeney didn't arrive at the payphone until 3 a.m.
Wow.
Yeah, very low priority.
Wow.
And also, what else, like,
a small town, what else are they doing?
That's what I was going to say. So, I just like real quick recap of this man's night. He worked 4 p.m. to 11 p.m., went home, got or went to on his way home, stopped for a burger and a coffee, and then got in a fight and then stood in a payphone for 2 hours. Like, I would be like, can I just go to bed? I wouldn't have waited there. I would have been like, I'm going back to my house. Like, it
I
is
would
what
have
it
at
is.
least wanted to do a drive-by and seen if I could still see the guy. And
Yeah.
then if he's still in my driveway, maybe like
Also, like, he
run him over.
didn't. I don't know. I was gonna say, even like, even if I wasn't, con if even if I was not concerned about my own well-being after 2 hours, it wouldn't. I don't know. I might go home and check on my mom.
Yeah, especially if she wasn't answering when I was calling multiple times.
Yeah, I think I'd probably wait about 20 minutes for the police and then be like, okay. Also, I didn't see anything about him calling back.
He's a very patient man.
He is a very
I would be
patient
making a nuisance of myself.
man. So, when Corporal Kinney arrived, Charles explained the situation and said he'd seen the man hanging around his home and wanted someone to go there with him. Corporal Kinney escorted Charles home, and the mysterious man was nowhere to be found. Charles's trailer was undamaged, the doors were locked, and nothing seemed amiss. Charles requested the corporal check Dorothy's home since they live so close. Corporal Keeney arrived or agreed, and the two walked across the yard to the back of the farmhouse. There, they discovered the window on the back door had been broken. Corporal Keeney found the broken window interesting because the window was kind of out of reach for the lock of the back door. So it was kind of like, It's something she just kind of put in the back of her head, made a note of it, and then continued on with her investigation. She and Charles entered the home. Charles called out for his mother. No response. Darth, which he thought was odd because Dorothy usually stayed awake until her son got home from work. So he was a bit concerned at this point. But so Charles usually gets home at like 12:30, and it was past 3 a.m. at this point. So like I would have fallen asleep. Like, or if I was his mom and was worried about him, I might have called the police and been like, hey, my son hasn't come home. But I don't know. I wouldn't have been so. I don't know. Charles and Corporal Keeney began searching the home for Dorothy and/or the strange man. In the upstairs. So, real quick before I continue on, do you guys think it's weird that she was searching the house with Charles? Yeah.
Yeah, instead of being like, wait out here, let me check it out.
'Cause like I have to assume that Charles doesn't have like a weapon and
No, I would assume that if he did, he would have used it during the
yeah.
attempted carjacking.
So like you just have this random
Yeah.
civilian walking
And
around
like,
a house.
it'd be one thing if the door was just unlocked, like there was no signs of a break-in. Sure, you can come in and check on your mom with me. But
Yeah.
there's a sign of a break-in. So like
My expectations for the corporal are pretty low after
he
the
was
almost 2 hour wait time for a
That's
response.
not her
Fair.
fault.
Well, she's the only person I have a name for, so.
Well, who's whoever the 911 operator who deemed it a low priority.
Yeah, I'll also blame them. My
Also,
expectations are still
which
low
also,
for
how
law
busy are
enforcement
they?
here.
Well,
At
so then
1 a.m.
the other thing that I want to point out is that she's with the state police. So, like, do they not have like a local police
It
department?
might be small enough that they didn't have a local.
Yeah, so then maybe she had to travel from far away
Yeah.
in her defense. But I just thought it was weird that she just kind of like let him tag along. Maybe she was like originally like stay outside and he was like, no, like there's a man out here somewhere.
He agreed to be her backup or something, or maybe they were like short-staffed. Because it also just like you only send one cop for like
It's a
a
low
strange
priority.
I know that.
He could have also just, like, refused. He could have been like, listen, that's my mom. Somebody broke in. I'm coming in. You can't stop me. And yeah, she was like, well, I'm not going to waste time trying to stop you then.
So, in the upstairs bedroom, they found a bloody and brutal scene.
Oh.
Dorothy was lying in bed, covered in blood, with a pillow placed over her face. She had been stabbed more than 20 times in the face, arms, and chest.
Dorothy. That's exhausting. Jesus.
So, I'm going to tell you a little bit about Dorothy before we move on. And I'm going to put that photo up because she liked her grandkids. So don't be mean to her. Dorothy Donovan was born Dorothy Mae Bonnie on May 18th, 1921 in Burrsville, Maryland. She was the second of three daughters born to John and Ethel Boney. She married Wallace Holden and became Dorothy Holden. And, you know, I looked in a lot of newspapers. I could not find, like, a marriage announcement. So I don't know when they got married, but... But they had three children, Charles Wallace, Brenda Lee, and Diana Gale. In 1958, Wallace died from a heart attack at the age of 44. Dorothy was now a widow with an 8-year-old Charles, a 7-year-old Brenda, and a 4-year-old Diana. Sometime later, she married Ralph Donovan. Ralph later died in July 1987 at the age of 66. Dorothy was described by her family as a loving and energetic woman. She loved gardening, canning vegetables, spending time with her 7 grandchildren, and going to church. So, an investigation into her death began immediately. The police believed that she had been killed around 1 a.m. because... I don't know. I didn't see a coroner's report saying that. I think they may have just been like, that's when the mysterious man was outside, so... I don't know. I don't have a whole lot of faith in this department. Her purse was untouched and the house seemed to be in order, making the police believe robbery was not a motive. To them, the attack seemed personal due to the amount of overkill. The position of Dorothy's body led them to believe that she had been sexually assaulted, but later during the autopsy, it was determined that she had not.
Oh, okay. Small mercies.
Yeah. The medical examiner listed the cause of death as massive hemorrhage, but could not determine the murder weapon.
So she died from bleeding out then? Yep. It wasn't like one of the stab wounds got her. That sucks.
Yeah. So detectives thought the scene was staged. Dorothy had no known enemies. Oh, they believe that it was staged just because, like, when they first walked in, they thought that she had been sexually assaulted based on her body position. But the fact that she wasn't, they were, like, staged. And the fact that she had a pillow over her face. Dorothy had no known enemies, so investigators pretty quickly became suspicious of Charles. Bailey is shocked.
Son?
Yes.
I mean, I can kind of get it.
His story about the mysterious stranger to them seemed like an elaborate alibi. Their suspicions were further bolstered by the strange comment he made when he discovered her body. He said, quote, I can't believe he killed her. I can't believe he killed her.
That feels like a normal comment. Yeah. When you find your murdered mother...
I think that they thought it was weird that his first thought was, like, he killed her. Like, he was, I don't know.
Well, I think that all of the law enforcement involved in this were a little bit stupid.
Also,
from the get-go.
Like, how can you judge someone immediately off the bat? Like,
they were really mean to him in his interrogation, too. Like, I put some quotes up there on the screen for you guys to look at.
Yeah, I understand that you need to look at the people who are closest to the victim. Like, I get that. I would expect them to check him out. But, I don't know, the whole, like, that feeling suspicious is weird. I can understand the story sounding a little bit weird. Like, you let us in with a story, and I just took it at face value as being true. But I could understand that if you find a body, and then the closest person to this person's like, I got a wild story about what happened to me tonight, that it could be suspicious.
He told investigators that the man must have killed his mother as a form of revenge because Charles didn't cough up his keys. So they were like, well, what did the man look like? He described him as, well, he described him and they made a composite sketch. So let me show you that. Or actually, I'll describe him first and then I'll show you the sketch. Charles described the suspect as being a black male in his late 20s, early 30s, about 5'8 or 5'9, weighing 150 pounds, with a slender build. He said the man had pockmarked complexion and wore brown dress pants, a brown plaid shirt, and big dark glasses. Detective Gregory Nolte found it really hard to believe that merely by coincidence, the man whom Charles picked up, drove a few miles, then dropped off, somehow showed up half a mile away at Dorothy's house and killed her. There were other homes in the area, so why would this stranger choose that house? And why would he choose to murder the occupant without, like, for seemingly no reason?
If he saw Charles's truck pull up, him thinking, oh, this is a fucking guy, happened to see the farmhouse, like, that close, figuring that it was on the same property, and was, I don't know.
You guys are believing Charles wholeheartedly, it seems.
I want to.
Well, you're not giving me, like, any evidence why he hates his mom.
Oh, I don't think it's hatred. Let me tell you some more.
I mean, you stabbed someone 20 times. Like, clearly you're not happy with him. Yeah. But if you really want to kill your mom, or in this situation, there's so many other ways to do it. And you don't need to come up with a stupid, elaborate lie.
But also, stabbing somebody 20 times doesn't sound like what you usually do to a stranger that you happened upon.
Unless you're in a rage or, like,
put a pillow over her face.
On something.
Well, I mean, that could just be remorse of not wanting to stare at her while you stab her.
Yeah. So, despite Charles having a facial injury consistent with his account of being punched, as well as a minor burn on his wrist from the spilled coffee, police could not believe his story. It was just too coincidental for them. And during their investigation, they discovered that shortly before her death, what did Dorothy do? Who can guess?
What did she do?
She took out an
Insurance policy.
Yes. She took out an accidental death life insurance policy, listing Charles as the beneficiary.
Oh, no.
Does murder count as accidental death?
It's not natural cause.
What?
So it's not natural causes.
Yeah, she didn't die on purpose.
But, like, accidental, like, I would assume, like, a car crash or, like,
fell down the stairs or something.
Falling off a cliff.
They also uncovered that Charles was in a bit of financial trouble.
So he lives in a trailer.
He was struggling with farming debt. Investigators asked Charles to take a polygraph exam, and he refused. Which, I know it doesn't mean much, but, you know, just something to add to the pile of reasons to be like... You are in love with this man.
No, I'm not. I play devil's advocate. I'm just saying, like, I don't know if I would agree to a polygraph, even if I know I didn't do it.
Why? Because the police detectives are telling you things like, what you said happened doesn't make sense, and you are not believable, Charles. You're saying the words, but you're not convincing. Is that why you don't think that you would say, take a polygraph?
Because...
He's telling you you're not believable. Why would the polygraph help? Well, okay.
For a good reason. But they're just unreliable.
Yeah, we've read too many where somebody failed a polygraph but they weren't lying, or they passed it but they were, and at this point we know they're not reliable. They're not even admissible in court anymore. It's like, exactly. The system knows they're not reliable. I would not take one either.
At the crime scene, investigators found a ton of bloody fingerprints, but they were mostly just smudges. So they couldn't really do anything with those. But then they found a
all blood spatter down the stairs.
I honestly, Lacey, I don't know. I don't think so, because I know how the story ends.
Okay.
But I don't know what it is.
Yeah, that's weird.
But they did find a partial palm print right here on the banister of the stairs. So they compared the palm print to one of Charles Holden's and found, what do you think they found?
Well, even the fact that you don't like how we're defending him, I'm going with a partial match.
I'm saying they don't match. I don't want him to have stabbed his mom 20 times. I don't like that.
It was not a match. And you know what? I really wanted to put a picture of, like, Mari. You are not the father. But the police didn't rule Charles out yet. He may not have committed the murder, but maybe he's hired someone to do it for him. Police went to the Hardys and interviewed people who'd been at the restaurant the night of the murder. They found and spoke to many witnesses who confirmed that they'd seen a black man walking through the parking lot asking for rides. Some witnesses told police they'd seen the man get into Charles's truck and drive off. Detectives put together a photo lineup of known criminals who fit the description, really just black men with big glasses, and they showed the lineup to Charles and to the witnesses at Hardee's. Three witnesses and Charles all picked out one man, Richard Mitchell.
That's Mitchell, a pretty composite sketch.
Mitchell bore a striking resemblance to the composite sketch. He had a criminal history of forgery and petty theft. Police tracked Mitchell down to his home in town, but before even talking to him, they realized that he could not have been their guy. The man they were looking for was clean-shaven. Mitchell had a full-ass beard. Mm. And those you can't just grow overnight, so.
You can glue them.
In the 90s?
Yeah, it's just movie makeup.
Yeah, I know, but I feel like they didn't look real. Anyway. Also, I will say, his previous convictions were for forgery and petty theft. It's a pretty big jump to go from that to murder. And then also, like, the fact that he didn't steal anything.
Maybe he was evolving.
Okay, I'm just going to tell you, he's not involved.
Okay.
Just to be sure. The police decided...
Was it the sisters?
Charles' sisters?
Yeah.
Oh, they're like in Philadelphia. They have nothing to do with this.
Oh.
Yeah. Just to be sure, they double checked and they took a look at his palm print and they tried to match it to the one they found in blood on the banister. It was not a match. And he also had a solid alibi for the night of the murder. So it wasn't Richard. That's when they found the clue they needed. Blood on the light switch in the living room. Blood that did not belong to Dorothy Donovan.
Ooh.
So they sent a sample of the blood to FBI crime lab to get it tested against Charles's blood, as well as every other suspect they had. Because throw everything against the wall, see what sticks. Also, they are not giving up on Charles, which I will commend them, even though they seem to have, like, tunnel vision for Charles, they're still investigating.
Okay.
So everybody they sent, negative. Charles was not a match to the blood found in the living room, Which, even if he was, I'm sure he could have, like, argued, like, yeah, it's my mom's house. Sometimes I bleed. But anyway.
Sometimes I bleed.
I cut my hand going in that night.
But it was 1991, so they couldn't get much more information. And that's where the case went cold, with no new clues or leads coming to light for over 10 years. It was cold, and it kind of just sat. And then CODIS was invented.
Yay!
Yay! Snaps for CODIS. So, more than 10 years later, in 2004, the DNA was uploaded to CODIS. And in November 2005, so like over a year later, a match was found. Well, the reason is because the match wasn't input into CODIS until September of that year. So it kind of just like was no match for a year. And then it came up and it was like, oh, hello. So they found a match. Say hello to 41-year-old Gilbert E. Cannon.
That looks so much more like the composite than that other guy did.
Yeah, the nose fits better.
The nose is better, the lips are better.
So that is like
the hairline. More,
like current photo. Look at his. That's his photo from like 1991.
That was an X. That was the best composite I have ever seen. Sometimes they look so goofy.
I feel like the chins are different though. I don't know, it feels like the chin is like wider, but it could also just be the fact that the picture is in black and white.
I think it's a great one. I think the glasses are a little wrong, but it's a great
The black and white plus his little bit of not fur, stubble or whatever he had going on at that point makes it look even
thinner. Okay, so we've got the guy. Yes. We arrested the guy.
41-year-old Gilbert E. Cannon was a career criminal.
Sure.
He had previous convictions in the state of Delaware for robbery, theft, escape after conviction, a resisting arrest, disorderly conduct, burglary, and assault, dating back until 1981. In 1996, he was convicted of escape after conviction while serving 1 year of violation, 1 year for violation of probation. He was released from a Maryland prison in September after serving more than 7 years of a 12-year sentence for robbery. His DNA was uploaded to CODIS prior to his release. Cannon had earned good time credits and was placed on mandatory supervision, requiring him to report to a parole officer. But in November, he violated his probation and a warrant was ordered. He, like, is really committed to not following the law. While investigating Cannon, police discovered that he'd been living in Delaware at the time of Dorothy's murder. And his mugshot from the 90s looked a lot like the composite sketch. So obviously the police wanted to talk to him. But by the time they discovered the DNA match in November, no one knew where he had gone. Because he wasn't checking in with his parole officer. And, you know, they also wanted to talk to him.
I bet. He's just ghosting everybody.
Mm-hmm. At the time of his... Oh, I already said that. By the time they investigated him, his parole officer was also looking for him. So everybody was just like, where'd he go? 2.5 months later, police were able to locate Cannon 40 miles away from Dorothy's house at his girlfriend's house. He was arrested on January 18th, 2006. Cannon adamantly denied being involved in the murder, even though investigators knew that his DNA and prints were found at the scene. They collected another set of prints anyway, just to get a fresh set and to just check it again and ensure it was a match. The fresh set was compared to the evidence, and the results were clear. Gilbert Cannon was the person who left the bloody palm print in Dorothy's home. The investigators informed Cannon of this evidence, but he continued to deny killing Dorothy. However, after having some time to reflect, Cannon knocked on the window of his holding cell. He was ready to talk.
Time to reflect just sounds funny.
I had it. I thought that was nice. Like, maybe... I pictured him sitting in his cell being like, oh, you know what?
This is not going to go well for me.
Yeah, they have like so much evidence against me. He told police that on the night in question, he went out high on cocaine looking for more. I said it that way because Lacey earlier said that he must have been on something.
Ian, that's fair.
While looking, he ran into Charles Holden at Hardee's. He told police that he asked Charles for a ride to Georgetown, and Charles agreed to take him to the turnpike. But Charles stopped earlier than Cannon expected, and a fight ensued. He told police he grabbed a screwdriver from Charles's truck, and the fight continued outside until Charles agreed to drive Cannon the rest of the way. Then Charles jumped in the car and drove away, leaving Cannon alone in the middle of nowhere. Like a real dick.
Yeah. How dare he? Okay.
Cannon said that he had no choice but to walk down the road in the direction that he saw. He said in the same direction, but Charles said that he drove in the opposite direction, so...
Are we going to believe the person that was high on cocaine?
I'm willing to.
I mean, you were trying to get us to turn on Charles earlier.
I wanted you to look the other way.
I can't when the evidence is not pointing towards him.
What evidence? He didn't have any evidence.
Exactly. Anyway, I'm that good of a detective.
Charles. He passed several houses, but avoided them because they had lights on. Mm-hmm. He told police he was looking for a place to sleep. So the first dark house he came upon just happened to belong to Dorothy. But he was looking in the window of Charles's trailer, so I'm wondering if he was just, like, doing a Goldilocks kind of move, or he was like, this house is too small. This house is just right. He thought the house looked empty, so he broke in through the back door, waking Dorothy. She got out of bed to investigate and found herself at the top of the stairs staring down at Gilbert Cannon. Cannon, worried that Dorothy would be able to identify him, ran up the stairs, chasing Dorothy back to her bedroom. He remembered putting his hands over her mouth, pushing her back onto the bed. He claimed to not remember anything else, but he also said that he stabbed her with the screwdriver from Charles's truck in a drug-fueled rage. And as he fled the home, he left his DNA and palm print. Which, real quick, if the medical examiner had been able to identify the murder weapon and said it was a screwdriver, and, like, I was, when I read that, Charles is lucky. Because, like, I'm assuming they didn't find the screwdriver on the scene. Because otherwise they would have been like, there's a screwdriver. But if they had found the screwdriver on the screen and been able to, like, tie it to Charles... Because, you know, his DNA would be on it. It's his screwdriver. Yeah. That would have been the end of it for him. They'd be like, she was killed with your screwdriver and your story is stupid. Do you disagree?
No, I agree. I think that would have been damning evidence.
Bailey's making faces.
No, I agree. I'm more like just... Dorothy's like a brave woman. If I heard a noise downstairs, I would be locking my bedroom door and getting a weapon. I
thought maybe it was Charles. I don't know. But
I'm of the high.
It was a friendly town, so I don't think that her first thought was like, oh, must have been someone breaking in. But
well, not anymore.
Cannon crossed the yard to escape when Charles drove by and saw him. So when Charles drove by and saw him, like, looking through windows and stuff...
He'd already killed her.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So even, like, because at first when I was reading this, I was like, if the police had gotten there earlier, they could have prevented this. But he hadn't even made the call yet. Cannon told police he didn't know Dorothy, and he was shocked to find out that she was Charles's mother. He too was like, whoa, what a coincidence.
Wild.
The police were relieved to learn that Charles was not connected or responsible for the murder at all, much like Lacey. Gilbert Cannon was charged with first-degree murder, burglary, and possession of a deadly weapon during a felony. Cannon's defense attorney, Robert Harpster, tried to convince the court that Gilbert did not work alone. He pointed to the fact that Charles was the main suspect for years until Cannon was identified. He also argued that it was quite a coincidence that Cannon ended up at Dorothy's house shortly after hitchhiking a ride from her son.
Leave Charles alone.
Also, Charles' financial issues and Dorothy's life insurance policy. To him, it just seemed very coincidental. Harpster said the pillow placed over Dorothy's face could be attributed to an assailant who knew his victim and did not want to look at her. Plus, the positioning of the body indicated a staged scene. But when faced with the possibility of the death penalty, Cannon made a deal. He pleaded guilty to first-degree murder and was sentenced to life without parole. He's currently serving his sentence at James T. Vaughn Correctional Center. Dorothy was buried next to her second husband, Ralph. And in the years between her death and the conviction of Gilbert Cannon, Dorothy's children became estranged. So when Bailey mentioned the daughters, I was really tempted to be like, oh, they're not involved and they're pissed. Like, they blamed Charles for her death. And I still, like, they apparently, like, they apologized once Gilbert was arrested, but I still feel like they probably are, like, if they were petty, they might still be like, well, it's your fault he ended up at the house. Like,
yeah. I feel like it would be hard to let go after, like, you held on to that for so many of the years, blaming him. Yeah. You'd hard to turn around and be like, oh, we were super wrong. And if I were him, I don't think I would care for their apology anyway. Apologies. Go to hell. You thought I killed Mom? No.
I mean,
Sorry, go ahead.
There's a hell of a lot of coincidences.
I feel like this question that I was about to ask, you're about to answer it. I was going to say, do you guys think that he was involved at all?
No.
I don't think so.
No?
I think there are wild coincidences, but I don't think so. I think this guy would have given him up once he was caught.
I'm still confused about, like, if she got accidental life insurance, how does that pay out for murder?
It must just be an umbrella that covers a bunch of stuff.
I think that...
But insurance is so, like, strict, though, and they don't want to pay at all.
Well, did they say that Charles was, like, the beneficiary of this life insurance policy. Did they say it ever ended up paying out to him?
No. But I do, I think accidental, I think murder falls under that umbrella.
Yeah.
I think suicide doesn't, but, like...
Yeah, I really feel like it's anything other than, like, suicide or natural causes. Just, like, here's in case something weird happens to you.
I also think with, like, the whole pillow thing, like, if he's in a, like, a drug-induced rage, who's to say, like, after all the adrenaline that he burned through stabbing her 20 times, he didn't, like, come to see what he did and then try to cover her, yeah, like, with remorse and, like, pillow. I just
killed an old lady.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How'd they get him for first-degree murder? Because, like, this wasn't premeditated.
Really think about that.
I don't know. Oh. You know how each state has a different, like, qualification?
Oh.
I'm busy looking up whether or not...
The insurance?
A death due to homicide would also be considered as accidental death in most instances, since the manner of death is both sudden and unexpected. However, benefits would not be payable for natural death, even if it occurs suddenly, or for suicide. So it's like Lacey was reading this.
Lacey, were you reading it?
Just in my mind.
Oh, okay.
Sometimes I know stuff. Sometimes I guess really well.
You're so smart.
Okay, so it seems like for Delaware, first-degree murder is committed if you intentionally cause the death of another person.
Okay, so it doesn't have to be planned out, it just has to be deliberate.
Yeah, recklessly causing the death of another person while engaged in the commission of or attempt to commit or flight after committing or attempting to commit any felony, intentionally causing another person to commit suicide, recklessly causing the death of a law enforcement officer, CO, firefighter, paramedic, EMT, blah, 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 causing the death of another person by the use of a bomb, causing the death of another person in order to avoid or prevent the lawful arrest of any person. So it seems like Delaware's first degree murder charge is kind of just murder.
Got it.
Real quick, off topic. Like I said earlier, I read a lot of news, like newspapers, like old ones, to find information about this case. And like just the stuff they wrote about back then was very amusing to me. So in the newspaper has like mini columns along it. It's not like the straight across bit. And in the center column, the little subtitle says, "Changes his mind, enlists in army." It's about Dorothy's first husband, Wallace. He enlisted in the army when he was 20, filled out all the paperwork, and then disappeared. Then he changed his mind and enlisted again. And that made the newspaper.
It's a slow news day.
But then under that, subtitle, man dismissed in manslaughter case. This one feels like, okay. It's about how Peter Gentile of 1109 Maple Street, they printed their addresses. Peter hit and killed a 4-year-old after she ran out in front of his car.
Holy shit.
Yeah, a little article says that he was dismissed on his manslaughter case. I don't know. Under that title, dismiss him. That's all it says. Harry Kong, Chinese, of 1201-12 Walnut Street, facing two serious charges, was dismissed by Judge Lin today. The complaint was from the mothers of 2 9-year-old N-word girls.
Jesus.
Not like the rough N-word, but like the one that ends in an O.
I figured. Year was that printed?
He was 20, so the 40s.
Okay.
And then the very last one, which I thought was the best. The subtitle says, John Farnan, seriously ill.
John?
They printed his age and address and how his sons have traveled from Denver and L.A. to be by his side.
Well, good they showed the address so you know where to send flowers.
Right? Oh my god. And like I was just like, they print the name of the guy who like killed a 4-year-old. Like
what? Yeah, address.
Yeah. But can, like, I don't know. Seriously ill. Let's put it in the news.
It was a slow news day, and they're also much more blunt about things.
Well, that was sinister.
And we were sarcastic.
And we hope you keep listening.